for one or two questions. So we could take time for one or two questions if you'd like to ask of the panel. You can speak loudly, it'd be fine.
I have a question about, I'd like to just hear more about the relationship with the lay community around him and how he relates to them and how he tailored the Dharma to their own
Well, well, he was because of the way he taught. Then it did have, it was applicable to whatever you are. You know, it wasn't a teaching only for monks or nuns. It's he could bring the Dhamma into the most practical situation. So some of the villagers, Thai villagers in the Ubon, were very much, they would tell me how they never understood Buddhism until they met Lumpucha. And they always thought before they met him that they could never practice it, that practice was so difficult that you had to have all these kind of accumulated virtues and you had to be a monk. And so they're quite generous in supporting us because they felt that we were doing it and they couldn't. But Lumpa Cha would get them to see it wasn't, that's just some kind of bias they have. And so he would give them ways of meditating, practicing too, in their village life and in their family life. So it was based on mindfulness, the basis of sila, samadhi, panya, or morality and developing meditation and insight and wisdom. But it would apply to anyone. And so he was quite a presence in Thailand. And influenced from the royal family down to the rice farmers of northeast Thailand and Westerners, because it was so simple and direct and applied to whoever you are, you know, whatever you have to live, however you have to live your life.
I don't think he diluted teachings, and I don't think there was like great. I was just saying. There didn't seem to be like special teachings for monks, and that they weren't available for lay people. The teachings that he gave seem to be very free and open, as they are from the monasteries now, for whoever is there present to receive them. And I also felt one of the things I really appreciated when the few times that I spent a little bit of time with him in England and Thailand was that he didn't dilute anything. Oh, because you're, you know, a young laywoman, you wouldn't understand the real essence of the teaching. In fact, he was very ruthless and and really, I felt at one point really was willing to be totally direct with me in terms of my own ignorance and in terms of really being, you know, giving a very immediate teaching about the nature of non-self. He didn't sort of hide that and say, well, you can only have access to this teaching after you've sat so many retreats or you've been a monk or nun for so many years. I mean, he didn't even know me, really. He just took the opportunity to go, boom, right in and give a very profound teaching. So I really appreciated that very much, that there was not, he didn't respond to the external appearance, but went to the hearts. You know, and sort of grabbed you in that way.
I'm curious about the Ajahn Chah's teaching style that you all talk about. I'm curious to know, did he pass that down to you? Is that the style that you use, or is, do you use like your own separate style? Do you know what I'm saying? You talked about how he taught in practical situations throughout your daily lives.
Well, he wasn't. He didn't have a lot of like technique. Wasn't so. He wasn't. Didn't have a kind of technique that he made you use. And it was an open kind of sense of reflecting on experience. And so in the monastic system, of course, you've got this container of discipline. So you've got something kind of very grounding to and clearly stated in terms of behavior. And it's restraining, you know, it's a restraining kind of practice. So this also brings up a lot of immature feelings and, you know, rebelliousness, because I could feel so rebellious towards this sometimes, or oppressed by it. But his point was not to, it wasn't to institutionalize us and kind of control us through a system, but to use this Vinaya as a agreed standard in monastery to reflect on our own behavior. And in, it's interesting, when I became the abbot for the first time in Wat Nanachat, I only had 8 years as a bhikkhu, you know, so, and it was actually, I didn't want to do it, actually. I didn't really want to have to be in that position. But there were so many Westerners coming, and there was always conflicts with Westerners and Thai monks, and you obviously needed to meet the demand that Westerners were making on teachings in English. So we established this, and in fact, Joseph was one of the original founders of that. And were you, or you were not one of them? But anyway, this was, and in fact, Joseph was the one that shamed me into going to this place. Because, you know, I remember he said to me one time, he said, you know, Ajahn Chah's talking about us establishing a monastery separate for teaching Westerners. And my first reaction was really negative. Oh, I don't want anything to do with that. And then he said, you're really selfish, aren't you? And I suddenly thought, yes, he is. He's right. I felt ashamed, but then I decided that I would do this. But then, if you've never been in such a position, you've got the role model of Ajahn Chah. So then, when we first went to Wat Nanachat, it's just a forest. There's nothing in it, and we had to build up the villagers, and they were very good about building things, but it's very primitive. And during that time, I just felt so frustrated because I felt so insecure in the role of having to be in the position of an ajahn or an abbot, and so I suffered a lot from this feeling of just inadequacy. And so then I'd get really down. I'd go up and see Ajahn Chah, and he'd look at me and he'd laugh and he'd say, oh, you thought being abbot was that you're going to just, you know, you get a triangular pillow to lean on, because they have these kind of triangular pillows that Ajahns usually have, and you can just sit there and you get first choice of all the food. And he laughed. He was laughing because he could. But it wasn't a kind of ridicule. It was a kind of empathy, you know. Because suddenly I started empathizing with him. I saw that he'd had what he had. You know, how difficult his position is, how it was, you know, and it wasn't, you know, when you're just a junior monk, you look at a great teacher, you think they, you know, you don't know what they've been through or what they have to put up with. You just assume that they're fine, but you aren't. And then I realized he was empathizing with me and I with him. I suddenly understood what it was like to be in his position or be in a position similar. And so then but I did have the insight during that time. I thought, what is it about Ajahn Chah? What is so special about him? And of course, many of the things you do follow the kind of strictness, or you try to do things the way he would do them, or, and that, and it would all come out very false, and nobody, you know, everybody knew I was being phony and false and trying to play Ajahn Chah, and so then I thought, no, it's not none of those things. It's because he is completely what he is, you know, that, because there are many monks who are very strict, who are not what I would, you know, I would not want to live with, or, you know, who have great learning and are very popular and acknowledged masters. But the special thing about Lung Po Chau was he was at ease and completely himself. And that gave me this sense of, that's all I have to do. I just learn to relax and just be myself. I don't have to emulate, or there is no kind of, I have to copy him or even other great monks. Just learn to trust and to develop from within the confines of my own character and not make that into the problem. So I trusted in that because, you know, that resonated as true. And so in my life as a monk, I haven't always lived up to everyone's expectations or wishes, but I do have an increasing sense of being at ease and with myself. And if that is useful to others, I'm quite willing to share it. But then if you know, that's their business, not mine. And so you know, you're beginning to see within the limits and of your own condition and situation to develop that confidence, and not let the world and the people around you intimidate you in always trying to please or live up to expectations or ideals. I've used the Four Noble Truths as this an ongoing reflection from my own experience of life.
One of the impressions that I've had in reconnecting with this tradition in recent years is like Ajahn Sumedho was saying, being at ease with himself, the different teachers in this tradition now, they all have their distinctive style of teaching, but it's when I reflect, I can see elements of Ajahn Chah's teaching. It's sort of like a yogurt culture or something that gets transmitted and creates more. Whereas in Thailand, there were a lot of Thai monks who lived around Ajahn Chah, and they copied all his mannerisms, his way of speaking. Some of them even had the same kind of false teeth and smile. And it didn't really come across as very authentic, even though they, you know, tried to, it seemed like they were really trying to copy him, the words and the mannerisms and everything, but listening to the Ajahn's teach, you know, and then also reconnecting with Ajahn Chah's teachings, and you can see that, you know, the elements are there, but the different teachers are expressing them in a kind of a living way. But it, you know, they weren't. It wasn't like there was, you know, a school to train teachers, but it happened that way.